Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
By the time a book is coming out, I'm like, I hate every word of this. It's so stupid and boring, and we're all so sick of it.
Yeah. And then people ask you questions about it in these interviews, and you're like, yeah, I don't know. Here. I'm sorry. I'm stupid.
Yeah. This book sucks. Just admit it.
I know. Let's stop pretending. Welcome to I'm a Writer But. My guest today is Amy Shearn. Amy Shearn is the author of the novels How Far is the Ocean from Here, featured as a notable debut by Poets and Writers and the Chicago Tribune, The Mermaid of Brooklyn, a selection of Target's Emerging Authors Program and a Hudson News Summer Reads pick, and Unseen City, the 2021 Independent Publisher Book Awards Gold Medal in Literary Fiction. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times Modern Love column, O, the Oprah Magazine, and several anthologies. A native Midwesterner, she earned an MFA from the University of Minnesota and now lives in Brooklyn, New York with her two children. Welcome, Amy. Okay, so I have asked Amy to read one of Edna Sloan's letters back to Seth, who Edna Sloan, who Seth Edwards has been looking for and has found, but now Seth himself is kind of missing and Edna's kind of writing to him and to the void, it seems. And so I have forced Amy to read this letter because I love it so much.
I love the way you said that, though. She is right to the void. I don't think I'd put it that way, but that's exactly right. You're so smart. Okay. Seth, dear. Well, now I'm worried. Where are you? Today, I woke up early and lay in bed, listening to a crotchety pair of squirrels bitch at each other on my fire escape, a true Manhattan pastoral. Is it lay or lie? Shit, I can never remember. Words escape me sometimes, though it feels like more of a willful rebellion on their part than like an escape act. I'm not even 60, and yet my son, the budding gerontologist, asks me old people questions all the time. But I swear it's the words and not me. It scares me, of course, since they're my true love. Where are they going? They would never forsake me, would they? Words often seem to me to be a slippery substance. Sometimes they are my perfect clay, my most beloved medium, the very air I breathe, in fact, in a place of deep comfort. But at other times, it's like I can't quite make them work. I can hardly understand them. And my words, my thoughts, start to seem like one of those dreams you can't even explain upon waking. My reality becomes fungible, porous, like I'm always almost about to find my way through it. And yet something keeps me away from perfect clarity, something humid as a greenhouse atmosphere. There and yet utterly not there. What I mean to write here is that I worry about you. Since you haven't written me back in your usual timely manner, and yes, 1,000 people have sent me the op-ed. Was that you? Solid clip, just saying. Funny, we started this correspondence the other way around entirely, didn't we? You seeking me out, me pushing you away until I only responded out of pity. You were like a very cute but annoying puppy that noses one's palm for pets until their needs become inevitable. No offense. And now, like a grouchy old man tenderly walking a fluffy shih tzu you know wasn't his idea, I have come to feel quite fondly about you, my dear. I have felt in your letters the presence, sometimes, of a true kindred spirit, of someone who understands me and my work more than I have myself at times. Fine, there, I said it. Are you happy? You really did win me over. And it really has meant something to have you out there, close but invisible, believing in me, like the reverse of an imaginary friend. Here's the thing I was going to tell you when we met in person, but that I shall write instead, just in case. You don't need to feel so tortured, my dear Seth. I know you feel like a weirdo, an outcast, like there's something wrong with your restlessness and fervor. Regular everyday life isn't enough for you, but actually that's not a problem. I mean, I understand that it doesn't feel good. But in actuality, this is why you will be one of the people, few in the grand scheme of things, to truly live. It's good to be a seeker. It's best to be a questioner. That's what separates us from the worms, my dear. Okay, now bear with me. I swear this is relevant. Do you believe in God? I know, an old-fashioned question, right? As for me, I'm still sorting this one out. For the outsized role that religious identity has played in my life and the life of my family, we never talked much about God. Scripture, yes. History, yes. Remember that Judaism is the religion of the book, and our prayer meetings on Saturday mornings went in drag as philosophical debates. We discussed what sections of Talmud meant. By we, I mean my father and the other old men, as I darted in and out, bored and wandering the temple, running my finger along the rough mid-century upholstery of the chairs in the synagogue, seeking out the best spots to hide, crushing myself into the folds of people's coats in the coat check room, breathing in foreign perfume, and when I felt bold, digging in pockets for mints and other treasure. But in the rabbi's study sat my father and his fellow survivors, like a weird fraternity for traumatized adults. And they would banter for hours, not about the cruelty of the world or the vicissitudes of history, but about lines of prose in an ancient book and what exactly its vague cone-like riddles might mean. Do you like this honking in the background? Can you hear this?
It's very, I can hear it. It's really charming. On my end, I've been muted. And so on my end, it's someone's drilling or sawing something. It's like city living.
Yeah. It's like a city living like audio reel.
Yeah, it's quite charming.
Okay, great take. I love that. Okay, I'm back. The honking has stopped. Okay, it's a religion for the brain, for people who want to be convinced, who are okay with feeling, but really prefer thinking. The conversations in that stuffy room centered largely not around, or so it seemed to be at the time, as a relative outsider, matters of the spirit, but around the letter of the law. What did this ordinance mean? What was the purpose of this or that ruling about food or behavior? But as for the matters of the spirit, as for what was the nature of God, well, maybe those matters were discussed elsewhere, or maybe they just weren't meant to be discussed at all. Maybe I was supposed to feel them with some sensing organ that doesn't have a name, that I'm not even sure I have, glean them between the lines of the text. I love the idea of a god. Even a council of pagan deities delights me, but I imagine it is there, something that can't be put into words, something we can't put pinned down. And yet when I trick myself into believing for a moment that a god might have created us, it seems very clear to me that this god would want us to create. Of course, that was her entire deal. Wouldn't she want the same from us? Creating things, making art, trying to understand our world by teasing it out onto paper or paint or symphonies, recording, if nothing else, the evidence that we were here. This means something. It does. I know it's hard to remember that when the climate is on fire and there are weapons in existence that could actually destroy the whole world as we know it, assuming our own rapacious appetites don't get to it first, but that couldn't really be our legacy on this planet, could it? Undoing everything it took a god or an accident of biology, even that is pretty astounding when you think about it, to create, that couldn't really be how this ends, could it? Our greatest act in exact inverse of God's? Poetic, maybe, but such a bummer. Who would write it that way? Not the same force that created Frisia and cumulus clouds and glow-in-the-dark cephalopods and hailstones look like gems, right? Where was I? Oh, right. I get that at times it's hard to believe that making art matters. But I have to think it does, Seth. I think you have to think that too. In fact, I think you know it. It's what you've been trying to tell me this whole time. I know you're restless. I know you're full of questions, and I'm sorry to throw Rilke at you like a strand of literary Mardi Gras beads, but you must, as he writes, live the questions now. Don't you see, Seth? It's not about the answers. If you knew all the answers, you wouldn't be the writer. You'd be a pundit. It's okay to have the questions. And it's okay not to know why you have the questions. You're the wild animal, not the zookeeper. And Seth, I'll let you in on a little secret. It can be fun. In fact, it needs to be fun. Listen, I know I was just doing a whole hopefulness spiel, but also we're on a sinking ship, pal. Smoke them if you got them. Have fun with it. Play. Romp around your sentences like a dog in a field. Dig into your words like a kid in a sandbox. Be here now. Like, feel it, man. You're one with everything, Seth. You're part of it. Everything you love in the world, that's in you and you're in it. There were a lot of really terrible things about growing up with a survivor as a parent, but there was a crucial thing too. And that was this deeply ingrained sense that every day, every breath of air, every moment your body is well-fed and not in pain, let alone feeling great and buzzing with energy and ideas, and even, let's add, feeling cute, wearing something you love, having that space suit of well-being we are occasionally, if we're lucky, clad in, every instant of that is a goddamn beautiful gift. I hope I don't sound like a beach house plaque here, all living and laughing and loving. I just want you to feel, dear child, the stupid, pure joy of being alive in the world. Let yourself feel it. I finished my book, by the way. I thought you'd want to know. Over the decades, this novel has been coalescing, as you've known all along. You've given me the nudge I needed to finish up, to contact my agent for the first time in a millennium. One more thing. I had a dream about you the other night. Isn't that embarrassing? You were in a swimming pool, Seth. I'm sorry if this makes you feel objectified. Take it up with my subconscious. She's nuts. Anyway, you swam beautifully through the water and then rose up holding a book. Yes, it was waterproof apparently. And it glowed and shone and you handed it to me. And I knew it was the most beautiful novel I'd ever read. And I was so proud of you. I wanted to tell you how proud I was of you, how happy to pass on the something, whatever it was in that weird dream logic. When I opened my mouth, black water poured out, and I knew I appeared to be a dangerous and ominous creature of the deep, and I was embarrassed, and I turned and ran. Seth, what I want to say is, I guess, this is embarrassing. Thank you. Love, Edna Sloan.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I haven't read that part of the book in so long.
It's beautiful, and you know... Like part of what the book gave me is like this notion that like time isn't a crime, not to be another like kind of like rhyming plaque.
Like
time ain't a crime. But like she has gone underground for a lot of different reasons. And she hasn't. I mean, she hasn't really gone underground. She has just lived her life away from the, you know, the lit scene. Mm-hmm. And you know, had to be present for her son and kind of be present for her own brain and just stop playing this game that she had been forced to play once she became published and became this big literary star. And like, you know, I read a whole book by Michaela Cole, who also, you know, purposely goes away, right? Like she completely checks out and she says that it's very necessary for her creative process. And Seth is in a world, he's young, he's working for a literary, buzzy literary site where it's about being like perpetually checked in and always, creating, you know, content and knowing what's new and having a new take on things. And it's wild to me how toxic that is. Yeah. Especially when we're all in it all the time, you know, like it becomes part of your life. You're like, oh, I feel bad. Why do I feel bad? Oh, because I was just on Instagram for 10 minutes and it made me feel terrible, you know? And we just do it. We just accept it as part of life. I find myself very like worried or scared about unplugging. And, you know, I've left out all other social media. All I have is Instagram, but I'm certainly on Instagram enough to where I'm up to date, you know? And what would it mean for my creative life if I'm not constantly in touch with the scene, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny to be talking about this book and trying to being in sort of the pre-pub promotion cycle of this book,
totally.
Because this book is so much about like how the other, right, the side of it that Edna tries to get back in touch with, and that in What You Had Me Read, she's kind of reminding Seth about like, here's why we do this. Mm-hmm. Like, let's make mm-hmm. art. Let's think about that. And I feel like I think about this a lot, how to make art and certainly to write anything, let alone something personal or difficult to write, you have to be so porous and so open and be paying attention to things and be open to things and let yourself be vulnerable and feel things and also just be taking in art and like living in the world. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. And then once you're starting to think of the writing as a product that's outside of yourself, whether that's an article that you, like Seth, have to write for work and have to pay attention to the traffic on it, or a book that you're trying to get people to pay attention to or something like that, it becomes this, it's like you have to sort of activate this totally different part of yourself that's mm-hmm. has a thick skin and is like has a background in marketing or something.
Right.
And, that's and the is thing. Like, here, please buy my product. And then also we're made to feel like it is so important to be online all the time. And like you said, connected to sort of this scene. And I find that I do like to be like, I've connected with so many great writers online. I think I first came across you on Instagram. I was like, who's this fascinating person? You read her books and listen to her podcast obsessively. But then, right, knowing when it's sort of depleting you and taking too much, right, not feeding you creatively or in any way. It's a strange puzzle we've created for ourselves.
It really is. And I think also about like the prize of youth in in the literary world, which isn't actually true. Like we, you know, like there's tons of female aging authors whose books do great every time, you know, like, and so, but there is this notion of like, even with Edna Sloan, like, well, you know, she's too old now, you know, she's only, I kept thinking the whole time, she's only 57. Like that is right, so young, right.
You like know? This old God. Yeah.
Right. And so like to hear her talk about in the novel, the feeling of her senses being dulled and how she would give anything to have the same access to the sharpness of her senses as she did in her youth. Mm-hmm. Is something I had never really considered before, but they get dulled over time by a variety of things, you know, like you just like, sometimes you just want to go home and sit down, you know, right. You're tired. Okay. Like,
yeah.
And I just thought that was so beautiful. And so to have this novel where not only is this aging female writer being sought after in the first place for like, you know, nefarious content creating reasons, but really ultimately because there is a young writer who is truly not sure if he has a place in this world, in this literary world,
yeah,
because it's so far removed from like the impulse to make art, you know. It was such a triumph.
Oh good. Yeah, I mean, I love that you said that, because I think, right, it is a little insidious, the kind of worship of youth that, you know, it's obviously not unique to the literary world, but there's just something so exciting about the newest flavor of the month, the you know, prodigy. Edna Sloan, the character, has had that experience herself. Her first book came out in her 20s and was a big deal. And mm-hmm. part of what made her such a big figure is that it's like, oh, she's brilliant, the book is incredible, and she's young and hot. this is so much for us to hold in our heads at the same time. The woman could have these different sides of her. And of course that hasn't changed and has probably gotten worse with how just, I often think this, like, there's just too many pictures of writers now. Like, you know, what about the days when there were three pictures of a writer?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, it's this picture of Emily Dickinson.
Yes, exactly. I remember my queen, Am Holmes, had the same author photo forever. You know, it was like, this is what you're getting. Okay. You guys don't know me. You know, like, you're not in my life.
Right. I'm a writer. I don't have that many angles. Okay. It's just one. And then, of course, too, it's like looking at sort of the ugly side of that, but then also it was just so much fun to write. You know, it's kind of the fantasy of everyone loves this writer. I feel like, I don't know, all writers maybe have that fantasy that if you did kind of disappear, someone would be like, I need to find her.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I have that fantasy all the time.
Yeah. Be like, where's your, I mean, that is one of the more kind of insidious fantasies that we have about the publishing world, I think, is that someone out there is like going to be looking for your next piece. Right, there's going to be some agent or some editor or some fan who's like, we're dying for the next thing from you. And not just that they'll sort of forget about you. And I mean, there's a lot of, but
yeah, I remember, I've said this on the podcast before, but some agent who I really admire and I love their agency was like, just, this is meant to be comforting. This was on Twitter. This was meant to be comforting, but your agent is not waiting around for your next book.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's meant to be comforting.
Yeah. In a way it really is comforting. Cause like you said, it's the sort of time isn't a crime idea. Like take your time. It takes time to make something good. And then also to recover from making something good. Live your life as a human for a little bit.
That is so true. The recovery is a thing that I forget about every time.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like every time I get out of kind of a really intense novel moment, whether it's the sort of fever of creation or a really intense revision moment or a publication process, I feel like I have, it's like the dust clears and I just look around my apartment and I'm like, oh my God, what happened here?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Or it's like, oh, I don't have to think about myself 24 hours a day. I can think about other things,
Please find the Tupperware lids. That would be so soothing. Yeah, but there is, right, you need that kind of, those fallow periods. But then there is, I mean, I feel like I have this fantasy, and maybe it, I'm not sure where it came from. And maybe there were only ever two or three writers at a time who had this relationship with, you know, like you imagine there's some editor who's going to be like, let me take you out to a three martini lunch and find out what's next from you. I can't wait. Is that ever even real?
Maybe, so. But I don't know.
Anyway, but like, that's it, you know?
Yeah. It's such an interesting, like the world that Edna knew when she published her debut and, blew up was equally as, unfulfilling as the world that we are publishing in now, where we're expected to understand like how to go viral or how to reach readers and like how to do, you know, like I'm out here making reels, people. Okay. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. You know, someone make a reel for me.
Right.
and so like those kinds of things, what Edna's saying in the letter that I asked you to read is like, remember the thing that is human about you and treasure that.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously, I think we always kind of write the book that we need to read. And I think it was funny to read that passage out loud. It was like, oh, this is inspirational.
Yes.
I need to hear this again right now and every day, because it is kind of an irony of the writing life. And I remember a mentor of mine in graduate school saying something like this. And of course I didn't believe her. And of course she was totally right that, that there's kind of something wonderful in the time before you publish, that you can never quite get back, because it's like, you want, of course, the validation of publishing and to have a writing career and get to write another book and to connect with readers and all of the truly kind of otherworldly wonderful things that happen when you publish a book, but at the same time, then you want, and I think that I think Edna says this in the book, that then with every book you kind of want to go back to that place of writing as if it's your first book, yes. You know, and yep. like forgetting everything you learned and just and getting back to the art of it,
just like memory wipe, you know, just like we're back to like, can I do this? And like, let me figure this out. And like she says, having fun doing it,
yes,
without like thinking about any future or thinking about things that have happened in the past that you're trying to change or that you want to amplify or you want, you know, to happen again. And I will say that like, as soon as I finished reading this book, I finished reading it, I think on Saturday morning, I immediately just went to my laptop and I started working on a thing that I've been,
oh, good.
it just gave me like, it was like a breath. It was really like taking a really, really cleansing breath.
That's so deeply satisfying to hear. Oh my God.
It just made me feel like, oh, okay. She is still like this great writer. It's still in her. Time passed, but that's okay. And I had been blocked by that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think too, when I was writing this book, I feel like I was feeling very blocked by, or like rejected by the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. And just, I was in a moment where I was like, well, I guess I'm never going to publish a book again. Mm-hmm. I was having a hard time finding a publisher for my third book, Unseen City, which ended up coming out in 2020.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, okay, fine. I guess my, you know, in that slightly self-pitying dramatic way that sometimes writers have, like, I guess my career's over. I guess right. No cares.
Yep. Yep.
And then this voice kind of started talking to me. And I feel like this book came out of that conversation with myself. Like, why am I doing this? What are the rewards of doing this? What's the point? And then, of course, this kind of annoying, bossy voice of Edna Sloan popped up and was like, come on, you know, you're not going to stop. You know, you want to make art, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And every time you have to, I tell my students, like, every time I've written a novel, I've had to teach myself how to write a novel because yeah. you're, but in a yeah. sense, you also have to like reteach yourself or re-give yourself permission.
Yeah.
And that can be hard.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell, you've probably had the same experience teaching. I feel like I've had so many students in workshop who, you know, they take their first workshop and then they're like, all right, so let me get this right. I'm going to work really, really hard. It's not that fun. I'm going to have to revise a lot, face a lot of rejection, and then maybe publish a book. And for what? And then that's it. And then people just judge your book. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And you're like, and nobody makes money doing this. Like, very few of us make any money.
And most of the time you feel bad. Doesn't sound great.
I know. It's like you have to hold those things at bay so that you can just focus on the scene that you're trying to write or the word that you're trying to choose. Because if you think about it that way, you know, like I always think, this is a completely toxic false thought that I tell myself, which is, you've got to write the next one now. Like, you've got it. Like, another one has to come out. You have to, like, it has to, things keep having to move, you know? Because I worry so much. But I've been that way my whole life. I've been that way my whole life, where I just, things have to keep going. But then the feeling I got after reading Dear Edna Sloan was that, no, there can be another way.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that, because I feel that way too. And I think kind of to write in any way where one isn't making bajillions of dollars or has a serious multi-book contract, mm-hmm. to keep doing it, you do have to have that internal push to keep going. Like something mm-hmm. inside you has to be pushing you, because nothing else is going to. But yeah, I think, and then also we're told that. I mean, I remember being told, okay, so my first book came out, I found out I was pregnant with my oldest child the day my first book came out.
Oh my God. Wow.
It was a lot. It was kind of great, because anytime I started feeling anxious about one of the things, I could then feel anxious about the other one instead, you know, like take turns. And then I had this kid, and then I had another kid. And I remember my agent at the time being like, you know, you can't have five or more years between books. It just doesn't work.
Oh my God.
What else could I possibly do? And also it takes a long time to write a book.
Yeah.
Especially if you have anything else going on in your life, which everyone does. But it's like, yeah, some of that feeling of you have to hurry up, you have to keep going, you have to have a platform, you have to, it's like we have that thought because we're told that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think like a lot of the things that I have accomplished are like things that I get tired of gatekeepers. So I just do my own thing, you know, like I'm going to start a podcast or, you know, I'm always thinking about that too. Like, how can I do these things on my own terms? Cause I'm not good at whatever terms are being set, which is a lonely place. But then I can remember that there's tons of us out here feeling the same way, you know?
Yeah. And that's how really cool stuff gets made too.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I was talking to a class not too long ago and asking them about their hangups about, you know, like writing or embarking on this career. And, you know, that was kind of, they were like, I don't even know where to start. Like, I don't, you know, like where do I go to get published, you know? And I was like, well, if you don't find it, then you have to make it, you know, like you have to make it. And that will
I love that path.
Yeah.
I love that you ask your students that too.
Oh, it's so fun. It's such a great question.
Yeah. And because I think often newer writers haven't even really thought about or articulated kind of what is keeping them from doing the work that they want to do. And then also I think it's a good probing question too, because it's like, if the answer is, I just don't even know where to start. I feel like when I hear writers say that, I think it's usually a symptom of needing to spend a little more time just kind of in the world that you want to be in.
Right.
Like, read books that came out this year, read books that are first time writers, read literary magazines and that, you know, not the New Yorker, because there's so much going on. And I do think even though the internet is horrible and ruining all our brains and lives, it also, I think, has created a really sort of exciting literary world in which there's so many places to publish and so many groups and so many resources. If people are like, I don't know where to start, I'm sort of like, how much have you looked? There's a lot.
Just like turn around with your eyes closed and point and go there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And like, I tell them too, like, well, look around the room. There's someone here who's starting something or doing something.
Love that. Yeah.
You know, like there's just inevitably, that's the way it goes. You know, like people are up to really cool stuff and want help and collaborators and people to show up, you know, like, that's and how, like, I started, you know?
I love that. And I think that's so helpful too. Cause it's like, okay, yeah, look around, who's around you. Don't spin your wheels being like, try to get noticed or try to feel like I'm in the same world as like Jennifer Egan or someone who's just like not in the same realm as you. It's like, who else is just getting started or is doing the kind of thing you want to be doing and because then having a literary community, I feel like, is so satisfying.
Yes,
in so many ways. And also, you know, once you start getting more serious about your writing, you need those people in your life to like understand what's going on and talk you down.
Absolutely. Yes. I thought it was so funny. I want to hear from you where Seth came from, but I also, I want you to talk about the fact that he went to Iowa. So please continue.
That's funny. It's funny because I feel like a couple of my early readers were kind of like, Seth is a little annoying. And I mean, I feel like Seth is me. I mean, I feel like he's all of us. I really felt like I really actually was kind of exploring the idea of two kind of halves of the same person or kind of consciousness or character. Like, I feel like even their names are kind of inverses of each other, you know, like Seth Edwards and Edna Sloan.
Yes.
And I felt like he's like the young, hungry writer slash wannabe writer who's kind of doing more wanting than writing, mm-hmm. and just feels so hungry for it, and also his head is up his own ass so much. Mm-hmm. And Edna is like that, you know, she's like the art version, you know, she's like, I don't really know what the internet is. What I want to do is write a great book, and I'm going to do that in solitude for decades. And she's kind of so serious about the craft, and so, I mean, it is a privilege, I think. And that also is part of the kind of fantasy of writing. This was like, what would it be like to be one of those privileged writers who doesn't have to do anything but write books?
Oh my God.
Wouldn't that be amazing? It's mm-hmm. like a dispatch from another world. And she doesn't have that sort of anxious energy towards validation that he has, in part because she's already had it. She's had the world say, yes, you're a writer. In fact, you're a great writer. And she's like, okay, thank you. But what next? Like, I really know, how can I write something better? How can I get deeper? How can I get more real? Mm-hmm. And yeah, which is a long way of saying it. I just think they're two halves of the same. They're kind of the two parts of every writer, or maybe I just mean me, like aspirationally. And I did, I have worked in digital media a lot. So I've been on that side of trying to write the thing where, you know, your boss is like, you better get this. I've never worked at a place that was that traffic hungry, like a BuzzFeed or someplace like that, where you get paid based on clicks or however they used to do it mm-hmm. at some of those places. But right, where you can see in real time the traffic on the pieces that you've written or acquired or edited, and you're kind of held accountable for it. But also, especially in kind of early internet days, like, nobody really knew how to get eyes on a piece. So right. It's just like publishing a book, right? It's like you're asked to bring as many readers to it as you can, and nobody knows how to find those readers or get them there. And they're like, you figure it out. They're like, yes. Okay, I'm trying. And working in digital media always felt and feels, whenever I'm back there, like, yes, this is the kind of stuff I'm good at, is words and writing and editing and thinking about stories, I guess. And also feels so far from the kind of literary novel writing that I want to be doing off in a walled garden somewhere or something, which is never, you know, in my life, obviously. And I think, so I was an undergraduate at University of Iowa, to talk to the Iowa piece. Oh. And I did like there's like an undergraduate workshop thing you can do. And I did that. And so it was kind of adjacent to the workshop people, and was just very aware that it was this brilliant, extremely intense group of people who seemed, and it also might have just been that cohort. Like, I'm sure it's different all the time, but it's like the level of kind of competition and intensity, just observing it made me feel like, I don't know if I can go to graduate school, because mm-hmm. I don't know that my self-esteem can survive it. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up finding a program that was not like that. And I think there are many programs that are, maybe even it's like, helps to go to a program that's not super famous. And so the people who are there are just like, I just wanted to write.
You know?
I don't
yes.
know.
This is a related story. So this morning, I did a Peloton ride with let me start right off with some fellow moms from my kids' school. So we've made this little Peloton group and we do Pelotons together on Tuesdays. And I was like, okay, like I'm gonna go hard. Okay, like I'm gonna get as high of an output as I can get and smoke these ladies. Okay, I'm gonna show them that I still got it. And I was dying. Okay, the whole time I was like, I'm gonna hurt myself. And, you know, I came in third. Okay. And that was pushing myself to my absolute limits. And I feel like that's what it would have felt like if I got into Iowa grad workshop. Is the whole time I would have been like, this is not good for me, but I will show them.
I'm here. I feel like sometimes that's a little bit what it feels like being a writer in New York and probably in Chicago too, that you're just like, hey, I published a book, and literally everyone around you is like, yeah, so did I. And mine did obviously better in every way. And you're like, great, cool.
I will say, like, Chicago, back when I was part of the literary scene of Chicago, which I'm not so much anymore because of kids and life. It was very excited about everyone's writing. You know, like we were all really enthusiastic and like building off of each other. I didn't feel like, and we were excited about new people coming, and it felt like a very collaborative, like pumped scene.
Yeah, I love that.
Allowed me to really, I feel like, not be on the Peloton ride of doom and just like really like stretch my wings, you know, and like try things and, you know, like be there for other people. But but it is true that like, there's a lot of writers here, and there's even more in New York, you know, and it's, that can be, I'm sure that's the hard.
I mean, it's kind of great because it kind of just feels like a thing everyone does, you know, and you're like, I'm not so special. I'm just doing this thing. And then also I remember actually, so I ended up going to a very lovely graduate program at the University of Minnesota. And my teacher there, Charlie Baxter, I remember him saying that something he loved about going to New York is how it's just normal to be a creative person. Like if you meet someone, you're like, I'm a writer. They're like, okay, yeah. Like I know what that is. And, you know, my upstairs neighbor is Colson Whitehead or whatever it is. And in other places, you know, he described getting kind of a blank stare. He'd say, I'm actually kind of a well-known novelist. And they'd be like, you? Okay. which is kind of funny.
But yeah, my neighbors across the street were like, so you wrote a book? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, okay, well, when does it come out? And I was like, well, it came out in November. Yeah. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, you know, like, I want to get a copy. Where can I get a copy? And I'm like, anywhere. You can go anywhere. And they were like, wait, like I can go to the bookstore and get a copy? And I was like, yeah. Like they just, I think people think like you say you're a writer and you know, it's you publishing your book out of the trunk of your car or something, you know, like they're just like, wait, what? Really?
They're like, you?
My next door neighbors were like, you're on the internet. I Googled your name and you're on the internet. I'm like, yeah.
I've had that experience dating. I got divorced in early 2020. And so have.
You had a hell of a 2020.
Yeah, it's a big year. and so, right, encountered app dating for the first time as an adult in my 40s, which was very entertaining. And yeah, had that weird, that. There's that weird moment with people where they're like, so what's your last name? And you're like, okay, so I'm going to tell you, like, let's meet before you Google me. Cause there's not to be like, you're obviously going to Google me, but what psychopath wouldn't Google someone they're about to go and
do? I Google everyone.
Yeah, right?
Literally everyone.
I'm like, in a Zillow, your house.
I'm going to go on your LinkedIn. Okay. I'm going to figure all this out.
Due diligence. But yeah, that thing of being very Googleable and also having a lot of personal essays kind of in the world, and you just want to be like, okay, do you know the difference between a personal a narrative persona and a person?
Like, right, exactly. I'm not my modern love essay, even though that's very fancy that I got published in Modern Love, just so you know.
I did have someone on a date after my Modern Love essay. And I was like, oh yeah, don't worry, I won't write about you. And they had the absolute best response I've ever heard, which was, well, but that would just mean I wasn't extraordinary. Oh. I was like, you're sick in the head. I love it. You are well-suited to date writers and you're too nice and we have no drama and there isn't anything to write about, but thank you for being up for it. Yeah.
That could be for like modern meh. Modern eh.
Right. A very nice person. It was nice. That's it.
Yeah. That person will be somebody else's nice person. Like somebody else's perfect nice person, you know?
Yeah. I hope. Yeah. It's funny though to hear you talk about the sort of Chicago literary scene though, because I do feel like I was thinking about this. Listening to your podcast, I was thinking, I do feel like there's like an alternate reality in which I live in Chicago because I'm from the suburbs.
You're from Evanston, right?
Yeah, I grew up, I was born in Evanston. I grew up in Highland Park.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Gorgeous. And so I, oh yeah. Yeah. I'm like, is it? It is. I did not appreciate it very much. And now when I go back, I'm like, what an adorable place. My God. Why was I so full of angsty rage when I was a teenager here? But I do feel like there's an alternate reality in which I moved back to Chicago and like we're hanging out. And
yes, absolutely. Come back. Come on back.
You know, right? I have such a great apartment.
And it's cheap.
I know, right?
No, to your point about the suburbs, Jason Diamond had a book that came out called The Sprawl.
Oh, yeah.
A few years ago. And he talks about in it, like his parents moved to the suburbs, or his dad, I think he was living with his dad at the time, moved to the suburbs, you know, into like their dream house, you know, and he was absolutely miserable there. He was so lonely and bored and everything was the same. And I think all the time about like, oh God, you know, like if we moved just a little bit outside the city, you know, like we could have a bigger place, like everyone could have their own room or whatever. And then I think about Jason Diamond's book and I think, I can't do that to my kids, you know?
He's out there saving teenagers.
He is. I'm going to kill him. He's ruining my life.
I know. I feel like, because I really, like many people in Brooklyn, really have the upstate fantasy. And whenever I'm like, wouldn't it be great if we, you know, moved up to the Catskills, my kids who are teenagers are both like, are you trying to ruin our lives? Why would you even fantasize about that? How dare you?
They don't know. Okay. One day they'll know, but they don't know.
I'm like, we would have so many bathrooms, you guys.
The dream of peeing without someone standing there going, I have to pee. I have to pee. Hurry up. I have to pee.
Yeah. I do feel like I used to have, my dreams used to be like, I just want to publish, you know, and I just, I mean, I do still have book related dreams, of course, but it was just like, I just want to have a creative life. I just want to live as a writer. Is that possible? You know, when I was younger, it seemed like there's so much suspense, like, is it going to happen? And now I feel like I have just as fervently held dreams about like, maybe someday I'll have a dishwasher.
Oh, God.
In my apartment.
I thankfully do have a dishwasher, but I remember so viscerally not having a dishwasher and not having access to a washer and dryer and palpable relief of being like, I can walk to my washer and dryer in my pajamas and it's fine, you know, or like, I don't have to wash this fork because something will do it for me. It's so great. It is so great. I wish that for you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's the dream. Dream.
Tell me a little bit about writing for working with Red Hen Press.
Oh yeah, they're amazing. It's interesting because I have had the experience of publishing with both bigger presses and smaller presses. And even I did a project with a micro press. So I feel like I've just really seen a lot of different ways to publish. Mm-hmm. And right now, so I have a book coming out next year, Putnam. So I'm like, also, at the same time, I'm going through the indie process and the big five process.
That's amazing.
Well, thank you. It's more because I had a backlog than that I'm a fast writer. Like it seems like I'm a fast writer, but it's not that. Yeah, and it's so interesting to see the two processes right next to each other.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's wonderful things about both of them, and there's like meh things about both of them. I feel like my first two books came out with big five publishers, and it was like very, my editor was amazing. The editorial process was always incredible. Like the amount of attention I got, I feel like it was really from another world. And everyone I encountered was, and I think this is true just generally of when you encounter the people you work with who work in publishing, like they're nice, smart people who love books. Like there's no other reason to be working in publishing. So that experience has always been great. I think like from my first two books, it was very clear to me that they were not high on the publisher's priority list.
Oh my God. Wow.
Which I think is, I mean, that's like hopefully a writer has, if you're offered the choice, it is something to think about. Like there's all sorts of great things that come with publishing with a bigger publisher. But if it's the choice between being like kind of at the bottom of their list of priorities and publishing with maybe a bigger indie that where you're kind of more towards the top of their list of priorities, it feels really different as a writer.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
And Red Hen, I mean, they are one of the bigger indies, but so, and they have been publishing for, I think, 30 years or something. So it's like, they're like a well-oiled machine. They're very organized, which I think is not always the case with indie publishers. And it's like you're being welcomed into this big, cool literary family. Like, I feel like it feels like how I imagined publishing would feel, you know, like when they're in Pasadena in California, but when my editor is in town, she like reaches out and makes time to have lunch with me. And we have like a long leisurely lunch where we talk about literature. Like it's very dreamy.
That's the best.
Yeah, it's really nice. And they publish, I don't know how many novels this season, but it's like they have kind of like a small batch in the spring and a small batch in the fall. But it's like 20 or 30 books or something. Like it's an amount that they can kind of wrap their minds around. And so it's like, you know, if they're publishing your book that they really care about it, and you do feel that personalized attention, which is really nice. Yeah, it's kind of like a literary dream in a way.
That is really nice, because I do feel like sometimes with the bigger houses, you can get this feeling that they're like, we have allotted 72 minutes total for this entire month leading up to your book coming out for you to have access to us and for us to do anything on your book. And that's probably true. Yeah. You know, like there's so many other books coming out that they can only give you so much, especially if they don't deem you to be the splashy thing that other books would be.
And I feel like they have much more of that sort of the pressure of the week, the release week. Like it has to happen in this week, because if it's going to be a bestseller or anything like that, it's going to happen in this week. And then after your book comes out, it's kind of like, okay, bye. We'll see you when you have the next book. And that does not happen, at least with Red Hen. You know, it's like I also get the feeling like they're interested in writers' careers, not just the one book. So it is like stuff happens, and they're happy if something happens for your book years after it got published, where I feel like for a big five publisher, it's just like a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
And then also it's like, I get that. I remember with my first book which was, you know, like a quiet literary novel, really. I reread part of it recently and I was like, this is a very strange book. like, I can't believe Crown published it, but I remember trying to get the publicist on the phone about something a couple days before my book came out, and she was like, she's very sweet, you know, like 15 years old, like her, you know, just like the biggest job, so many books. She was trying to take care of. And I just remember saying, yeah, we're just so slammed this week because Pat Buchanan's book is coming out.
Oh
Remember
my
Pat
God.
Buchanan?
Of course. Yes. Oh my
I
God.
was like, all right, I understand that his book is probably funding books like mine. Or,
Yes.
you know, or like whatever your big cookbook is like funding my little advance you give me. And I do appreciate that. And I get that it's a business, but that was not a literary dream of mine to hear that be said.
I know. I know. It's like, it shocks me every time where I'm like, oh, okay. You know, did I like, was I supposed to be picking the ball up here? I don't.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's confusing. So tell me about the book that's coming out next year.
Yeah. So it's called Animal Instinct. It's, this is a book that I started writing in 2020, or started really
Wow.
taking notes for it when, so I got divorced, moved out into my own place in February of 2020. So it was
Oh
like,
my God.
and I was like, all right, let's, oh, be alone in the room. Okay. Okay. And then sort of like encountering the idea even of dating for the first time as an adult during a pandemic. And just thinking like, this is so weird and so fascinating. And I can't get over the weirdness of having sort of the most tumultuous time in my life coexist with a time in which everyone's life is a mess and everyone is confused and in existential weirdness. And so I kind of started taking notes for this book. And so the book, it's a novel, but it's about a woman who gets divorced and then there's a pandemic and she, is dating, you know, on the apps for the first time and keeps thinking, and she's an app developer
Oh
who
my
does
gosh,
work
wow.
with AI. And so she is thinking, well, no, I don't actually want to pick from who's available. I know what I want. Couldn't I just create my own perfect person? She starts playing with like an AI. It's like, it's just a chatbot basically to be her perfect person. And, you know, emotional hijinks ensue.
That sounds awesome.
You.
That sounds really good.
There's also just a lot of sex in it. So.
Yes, that's what I like to hear. Bring back sex in books, everyone.
Come on.
Come
My
on.
Favorite rejection for it was that one editor said, she said, I liked reading this. I don't think it's a good fit for our house. It's a bit saucy. So then my
What was that, like christianbiblebooks.com or something? What's happening here?
Yeah, I'll tell you later who it was.
Okay.
But and then my agent started calling me a saucy wench, which was actually my favorite thing that's ever happened. So
oh my God, that's your new Instagram handle.
Yeah. Saucy wench slash mom.
I love that. Moms can be saucy, everyone. Get over it. Okay.
Listen,
where do you think the babies came from?
Yeah, thank you. I was going to say that and I was like, don't say that. Yes, say that.
Well, Dear Edna Sloan comes out April 30th, which I believe in podcast time, if you're listening to it, the day this podcast comes out is today.
Stop it.
Yeah. Pub day drop for this episode.
Do it.
And it is so life-giving and so funny. And like I said, it really is like taking a deep, deep breath and remembering who the fuck you are and then going out in the world with that.
Thank you for saying that. That is my dream, is that a frustrated person reads this book and then feels a little better.
I did. I like could see clearly for the first time in a while. So I really can't thank you enough. I loved it.
Oh, thank you. And I'm so glad if that means there's going to be another Lindsay Hunter book pretty soon.
We'll see.
Take your time.
I need Seth Edwards to come find me.
Yeah. He's out there. He's going to write you something really annoying. You're like, oh, this guy.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. This has been a delight.
Thank you so much. I'm a big fan. Really
appreciate it. Thank you. honk some horns.
Okay.